Good afternoon, everyone. Hopefully you all had a very delicious lunch. I'd like to welcome you here today to hear the future of financial reporting with John Nicholls presenting. My name is Brylin Cummings. I think we're all in for a very interesting half hour as we learn about the new reporting that's coming our way, whether we want it to or not. John Nicholls is a senior consultant with Willis Towers Watson. He's based in Melbourne and joined the firm in 1990, transferring to his offices, for 4 years, and then 4 years in Brazil. His work includes helping clients develop a broad range of insurance products, advising on the design, costing, reserving and capital requirements for investment guarantees and the application of Australian IFRS-based accounting standards. He also helps clients develop financial projections for mergers and acquisitions, strategic planning, market entry and company licensing. Please welcome John.
Thanks, Brylin, and thanks for coming along today. First of all, apologies for those who might have seen Paul Caputo's name out the front and came in expecting him. Unfortunately, you just have to put up with me for the next period to look at the future of financial reporting. So just a quick agenda for what I plan to go through today. First of all, just a brief look at where we are now. Follow that, a little bit more detail around IFRS 2, looking particularly at the three main, I'll call, measurement models that are coming as part of IFRS Phase 2, and introduce some illustrations to show what might happen as we go from where we are today through to the impact of implementing under IFRS Phase 2. Quick look at some international developments and end up with a quick look at some implications. So, where are we now? We heard a bit yesterday from Google and Facebook about the nature of their organisations. Back in 1997, when ISC started looking at developing a standard for insurance contracts, those two behemoths didn't even exist on that. Yet here we are, almost 20 years later, and we still don't have that final standard for insurance contracts. We have an interim standard that pretty much said, keep doing what you're doing, subject to some tweaks, such as minimums around liability adequacy testing and the like. But it was pretty much continue with your current practice, which varies by country there. Since then, we've had a discussion paper in 2007, exposure draft back in 2010, a re-exposure draft in 2013. Maybe by the end of this year we'll actually have that final draft. Although, some of the wording from the ISB recently say that may not happen until 2017. Then, still a few years beyond that till we're actually going to have to implement what's coming in that standard. That said, what we're expecting is going to come into that standard, to some extent, particularly in terms of the core measurement, hasn't really changed a lot since that 2010 exposure draft. There have been some significant changes, but the basic components, which we'll look at shortly, were present in that draft and are still present now. So, kind of boil down what's going to be covered under IFRS Phase 2 into sort of four broad areas around the scope, so what's included, what's excluded, what should you combine together and treat as one contract, what should you separate and treat as a investment contract or revenue service contract, or measure within the insurance contract standard, which kind of leads into the next element around the measurement. How do we measure the contract when it was first issued and then subsequently over time? How do the components of the insurance contract liability vary as we go forward? Also deals with aspects around the presentation. What do we show in the P&L? What do we show in other comprehensive income? What goes in the balance sheet? And what's all the other bits of information we need to disclose around that? And mainly I'm going to focus today on measurement. We'll talk a little bit about presentation as we work through. And the final element then is around transition. You know, what do we actually have to do when we first go from or apply the standard, the final standard when it comes through, which is, you know, boils down to effectively the primary approach will be retrospective application. Work out what their liability would have been had the standard always applied. If it's impractical to do so, there'll be a simplified approach. If that too is impractical, you know, then there's a fair value approach that's set out for transition. As I sort of mentioned, you know, mainly going to focus today around measurement and a little bit around the presentation aspects. So in terms of measurement, I'm going to look at three, what I say are the main measurement models that we're expecting in the final standard. One I've labelled the general standard or core measurement approach, and that's what's illustrated on the slide here, the components of the general model. Then look at variable fee model, an alternative to that, and the third one we'll look at will be a kind of simplified approach, particularly for shorter duration contracts. The picture that's up on this slide is the one that say, yeah, it hasn't really changed a lot since the 2010 exposure draft. You know, the concept of the fulfillment cash flows being, you know, the present value of the cash flows, taking into account the asymmetry, plus a risk adjustment reflecting, you know, the company's compensation the company requires for bearing the risk of the variability of those cash flows. And the final element, the contractual service margin, essentially eliminates any day one gains and is kind of the mechanism for recognising that service margin over the life of the contract, similar way to the profit margin we currently have under MOZ. Next couple of slides just give a bit more detail around those elements. We won't go through those fairly quickly. So things around cash flows need to be explicit, unbiased, should be from the entity perspective, and also within the contract boundary. The contract boundary is going to be a new concept that will come with IFRS 4 Phase 2. It's in things such as Solvency 2 as well. But when we're measuring cash flows, we're going to measure them up to the contract boundary. So for many contracts, that's going to be reasonably well defined. For others, if you have the right to vary premiums, whether that's for an individual risk or for a group of policyholders, and the premiums you've charged to date don't relate to future periods, the contract boundary would end at that point. So in Australia, a lot of business that we call the yearly renewable term business is going to meet those definitions, and rather than being treated as a long-term contract, your contract boundary is going to come down to perhaps 1 year on that. Similarly, the group business might be a three-year contract depending on the level of the guarantee. So adjusted for the time value of money. So if my cash flows don't depend on the assets, basically I'll be discounted at a kind of risk-free rate. Possibly illiquidity adjustment for annuity-type cash flows. Where they do depend on the underlying assets, that dependence can get reflected in the discount rate. So, for participating-type contracts, similar to current measurement, we can take into account what we're expecting to earn and discount accordingly. And finally, the risk adjustment is compensation the insurer needs for bearing the risk. And, there's a couple of important things here, particularly that this can reflect diversification across portfolios. And effectively, the wording's around, reflect whatever diversification the company considers, when it's pricing for risk. So, I could kind of read that definition and say it's not necessarily just diversification within the entity. It could be diversification, across entities in a group, for example. Each reporting period, all these measures, get updated to reflect current environment, current view as to mortality, investment, etc. As we said, the contractual service margin is kind of that balancing element issue that eliminates the day one gain. It'll derive how profits emerge over time. And the standards expected to set out that that emergence is going to be based on the passage of time and taking into account the expected number of contracts in force. So, you know, rather than based on claims or premium, you know, it's a different basis for amortisation. Another key aspect is that, you know, as we amortise over time, that's going to be at a locked-in interest rate. So even though we update the measurement of the underlying fulfilment cash flows, you know, CSM amortising under the general model, you know, is going to be at a locked-in interest rate. So that's going to be quite an important complication. It does, though, get unlocked for changes in estimates of future cash flows. So in a similar way to the service margin, you know, the profit margin, you know, we currently have under MOS, change our view as to future expectations for mortality, lapse, whatever, that gets rebalanced through the contractual service margin. So if I switch over and start to think about the alternative, which we've labelled and called, been called or referred to as a variable fee approach, the components are actually exactly the same as what we have under the general model. So, you know, the diagram of the components, exactly the same. So it's the same elements, fulfilment, cash flows, contractual service margin. When I issue a contract, you know, it's going to be exactly the same measurement. You know, fulfilment cost, cash flows under the general model, under the variable fee model, should be the same. Contractual service margin at issue should be the same. How it's going to vary is how the contractual service margin gets released into profit over time. Okay. This is going to be available for products that have classified as direct participating contracts. So contracts... where this contract terms specify there's a pool where the policyholder is participating in the performance of that pool. That might be investment performance, mortality performance, etc. And the policy, the company has to pay a large amount of the return on that portfolio to the policyholders on that. The key distinction, though, is, you know, the company doesn't actually have to hold that pool. You know, they could define, I'm going to give you a share based on an equity index. That's fine. They can go invest in something completely different, but they'd end up with a big mismatch in that situation. It also, in valuing the cash flows, you know, it include cash flows whether I'm going to pay them to my current policyholders or to the future policyholders. So if I think you're like a typical participating fund that's getting managed over time, you know, the cash flows, you know, there's an intergenerational support of cash flows from one series of policyholders to another. Yeah, but so in valuing the cash flows here, you're taking into account not just what's going to the current policyholders, but any policyholder in the future. So a simple example of how this would work. So in this case, you know, shareholders entitled to 10% of investment return, policyholder 90%. Asset values go up by 100. Value of the fulfilment cash flow element is going to go up by 90. The difference of the 100 and the 90, that 10, increases the contractual service margin. So rather than coming through as an investment variance in the period, it increases contractual service margin and then gets released in the same way based on the passage of time or possibly if it's an investment contract based on asset management services. Okay. The final element we'd look at is simplified approach. So we talked a little before about, for example, YRT, you're only going to reflect cash flows up to a contract boundary, which might be 1 year when I can reprice the contract. There's a simplified measurement approach that can be applied if it would be a result in a reasonable approximation to the general model we talked about. And for contracts with a term of 12 months or less, it's kind of deemed that it would be a reasonable approximation, in which case you can effectively apply a simplified, basically an unearned premium type approach. That unearned premium might be net of acquisition costs. If the policy term is 12 months or less, you could ignore that complication and just do an unearned premium based on the gross premium, gross of acquisition costs. So essentially, there's going to be an option, and it is an option rather than applying the general model for YRT business, just do an unearned premium approach. But even if you do the general model and have to go through and work out your fulfillment cash flows and CSM, you're still only going to reflect those cash flows up to that contract boundary that's defined. Okay, so have a look now at some of the potential implications and what might change in going from where we are now to IFRS Phase 2. And we'll look quickly at level term, yearly renewable term, and then a participating investment account example. These are kind of simplified examples. Assumptions are not necessarily representative of what you'd apply in practice. Some of them have been set to highlight some of the differences. So looking first, level term. So what we would see if we look at a kind of source of profit type analysis would be that if everything's as expected, my profit margin is going to get released over time and my profit will just be the release of that profit margin. Whether it's going to actually increase like it's shown in the chart or decrease will depend on a number of factors, particularly the assumption the company used, but also particularly if the company's using claims or premium as the profit carrier. And for this example, it's claims rather than premium, and the interaction of how the mortality lapses work. It's coming with a increase in the profit margin over the contract term, which is a 10-year level term contract. If we look then, what would happen or what we'd consider under IFRS Phase 2, under the general measurement model, which would apply in this case, the source of earnings is really now, rather than just the release of profit margin, it's really the release of the contractual service margin, which has been done over time, so effectively based on number of policies running off, but also the release of the risk adjustment. So that's kind of the purple layer below the blue layer in the chart. And that might run off quite differently to how the contractual service margin runs off. But you can see, though, just that change in potentially using claims as the profit carrier through to a combination of the contractual service margin and the risk adjustment can lead to quite a different pattern in how the profits are going to emerge over time. The other thing we have on the chart, though, is potentially there's going to be expenses that are incurred that don't get reflected in the valuation basis under IFRS Phase 2 but are included for MOZ, particularly in relation to acquisition. The measurement's only going to take into account direct acquisition costs. So there's going to be some expenses that would normally fall within an acquisition cost be considered for MOZ, not going to be considered here. So some of the things there, the cost of recruiting agents or training agents is not a direct acquisition cost. The cost of developing a product to sell, is not a direct acquisition cost. So there's going to be some costs that are going to flow straight through to the P&L at the time of acquisition. There may also be some other expenses, overheads, that are not included in the ongoing expense basis. They're going to have less influence, though, on the shape of the profit distributions. It's those extra acquisition costs that are not getting reflected in the IFRS Phase 2 basis, though, is going to give this quite changed profit in that first year, because they're going to give you that big drop in profit, depending on your expense structure. On there. So the big change is potentially that first year profit is going to be quite influenced, quite different influence. There'll also be differences in what you recognise as revenue. Typically we're going to be recognising now premium income is our revenue. For IFRS Phase 2, we're going to have a different basis. So rather than something running down over time, in this example, it's reasonably flat. what is making up that revenue is effectively we're going to recognise as revenue the expected claims, the expected expenses, those fulfilment expenses, so not including anything that doesn't go into the valuation basis. There's also going to be an allowance for the amortisation of the acquisition expenses that are amortised and released over time, so that will be an element of revenue over time. Then on top of that is the release of the contractual service margin and the risk adjustment. So rather than premium, you know, that's quite a potentially quite a different pattern. Expand the chart out a little bit more. On the outgo side, you've then got your actual claims, actual expenses, including the fulfilment expenses and acquisition expenses. So then that combination, you know, will drive the profit result there coming through here. A lot of those items are similarly on the P&L that we'd have now. What we also have on a P&L now is going to be allowance for a change in liability. Yeah. No longer any need for that. You know, we're going to have some reconciliations in the notes, but there won't be a change in policy liability line on the revenue statement. Okay. What happens if experience doesn't come as we expect? Well, similar to Moz, you know, we're going to have an experience variation in the year it happens. Here, you know, mortality was a bit worse than we expected in year five. We get a drop in profits in year five. Nothing unexpected there. If I change an assumption, yeah, similar to Moz, yeah, that's going to affect my profits that are distributable going forward. You know, I'm not going to get that hit in the current period unless I get to the point where the contractual service margin is zero, at which point, you know, I would have to recognise that loss. So when that happens could vary between the two models, particularly because, you know, it's going to be happening under IFRS Phase 2, potentially particularly earlier because of the risk adjustment that isn't present in our current reporting standard. Okay. So quickly turning now to YRT, which we're going to be measuring again effectively as a short-term contract, basically based on unearned premiums. Effectively, you know, I'm no longer going to have those risk adjustment or service margin elements of profit, so I'm really just showing the total profit here. I'm also not getting that distribution that spread of acquisition expenses, so there's going to be much more of big loss in the first year, my high upfront commissions, higher margin in later years. Yeah. Presentation, you know, will be more similar to what it is now. So, you know, basically revenue will be premium and the expenses will be, or the cost elements the same as we have under the existing standard. And just the slide there, so yeah, revenue premium for the YRT under the simplified approach, you know, will be aligned with what they are currently, I would expect. What about participating investment accounts? So this is an example where the variable fee model will apply. So just on a simple example, you know, a pot of money sits there, no lapses, no tax. We're just going to distribute some, credit some interest over time and there'll be maturity value paid out. The valuation currently is driven by, you know, the value of supporting assets. So, yeah, it's a pot of money. It's going to increase as policy, as bonuses are declared, policyholder cash flows affect it, add my investment experience, adjust for interim bonuses, experience profits. The cost of supportable bonus or best estimate bonus comes out, the shareholder element associated with that, and that'll give me my supporting assets carry forward, and that, you know, it's essentially that which is driving the policy liability. I can split that into a BEL, future profit margins, but that's essentially what's driving it. Sitting outside that, the PRP and SRP, similarly, you can think of those accounts, you know, they decrease as bonuses are declared and shareholder elements are transferred out, maybe a little bit of investment income. The cost of best estimate bonus that comes out of the VSA and associated shareholder transfers increase those elements. Yeah. under IFRS Phase 2, you know, it's perhaps similar in some ways, effectively, you know, that value of a fulfilment cash flows, similar to an account value, you know, will carry forward, will be affected as we have cash flows. And there'll be an investment income element, you know, whether we work that out directly or it comes from just a balancing item to value of cash flows we determine at the end of the period. There's flexibility there. The other element is then the contractual service margin. You know, under the general model, effectively it's just going to increase with interest, locked in, get amortised over time. Under the variable fee, as we discussed, effectively under this example, any interest that doesn't go into that fulfilment cash flow bucket adjusts the contractual service margin that then gets released into profit over time. So under this example, so I've illustrated here, everything's happening as expected except in the first year where, you know, I don't earn as much interest as I expect. The variable fee approach, you know, it can actually align. It comes out and gives me exactly the same result for this simplified case as LPS 340 approach. Yeah. The general model would give a much different answer. That's kind of the blue one, which is, you know, much lower in the first element due to that, effectively that investment experience going straight to my P&L, not adjusting the contractual service margin. The black line is the distributed profits. You know, I have a bit of control over that because I didn't earn as much as I expected in the first year. You know, I didn't credit as much. I could then credit a little more in the later years, so the black line's a bit higher. But essentially, you know, there's going to be a lot of similarity. There's differences as well between the variable fee type approach and current MOS. Okay. That slide I put up there was assuming the distribution of profits is based on asset management services, which will be permitted if it's an investment contract with a participating feature, discretionary participating feature. If not, the CSM is going to get released just over time. In that case, you know, we would have quite a difference between the variable fee approach and the current LPS 340. It would be magnified even more so if there's a regular premium contract. So, you know, where things come out, you know, smoothly over time under IFRS Phase 2, you know, it's got a different shape to the increasing pattern we'd have as assets increase under the current LPS 340. So, yeah, there's going to be potentially some significant changes in how profits emerging in LPS IFRS 4 Phase 2. Yeah. So that's kind of a quick look at, you know, some of the implications for three different product types. Just before wrapping up, just a quick word on some international developments, not going to go into a lot of detail. Obviously, you know, Solvency II is now in place in Europe. Similarly, in Asia, you know, there's a lot of work around risk-based capital happening. Still some time off, you know, changes being implemented. In some jurisdictions, that said, China, you know, they have a new capital standard in place, the risk-orientated solvency system. That's just come in place at the start of this year. But a number of other jurisdictions in Asia, you know, look at their RBC framework. So Hong Kong, Singapore, example, of, you know, they have an RBC framework, but, you know, looking at phase two, I think, you know, Japan as well, looking at their RBC framework. Less changing around the primary reporting, you know, except in one or two exceptions. I think, you know, I think, for example, Philippines is perhaps going through a change to GPV type reporting there. In the US, for a while they were working on a joint project for insurance contracts. They kind of abandoned that and they're just going to make some targeted improvements to US GAAP. But that will include, particularly for Phase 60 business, which use locked-in assumptions, moving away from that to using more current assumptions for the Phase 60-type business there. There will also be changes to statutory reporting in the US, moving from kind of bases that have locked in assumptions to principles-based reserving, but that'll only be for new contracts once that starts to get implemented. Yeah. And then obviously underlying all that, yeah, IFRS is going to affect, you know, a lot of countries. According to their IASB website, you know, there's over 100 countries that requires IFRS accounting for most of their domestic publicly accountable entities. So, you know, a lot of those include the region of Asia. Big exception, obviously, you know, the US doesn't and doesn't permit it on that. So just finish up with some implications. So, yeah, we're certainly going to see more convergence as IFRS Phase 2 comes in. A lot of that, you know, grandfathered approaches will go away to a more universal type measurement approach. Not universal, yeah, but yeah, much more converged. Solvency regimes, perhaps less so. Solvency, we have Solvency II in Europe, but you know, countries are less committed to adapting exactly Solvency II. But there is more increasing consistency, and to some extent driven by IAS insurance core principles, and countries looking to be more aligned with what's coming there. What we'd see, profit's not going to relate to value. The profit that I see in a year isn't necessarily the value that's generated. The reserve is not taking into account all those expenses. If I sell a lot of YRT business, I'm probably going to show a loss. But I've really written a lot of profitable business, but that's only going to emerge over time. So to some extent, it's almost a step back to where we were pre-MOS on there. So because of that, there's still going to be room for supplemental measures. Issue of profit and value not being aligned was one of the big drivers why companies were interested in EV, why it's developed over time. Perhaps there's going to be more emphasis on that going forward. Well, for here in Australia, complexity. Things are going to be more complex. A couple of examples there. Use of other comprehensive income. Haven't talked a lot about that, but that's potentially going to be something that we're going to have to think about. We don't do it now. But also just the fact that interest rates for amortization and contractual service margin locked in. So each sort of period you're going to have different assumptions and you're going to have to maintain and manage that over time over there. When I'm rebalancing the contractual service margin for change in assumption, I've got to discount my cash flows at that locked in rate. So different discounting to what I'm using in the actual measurement there. Local guidance to some extent, I think, is lagging a bit. It's not necessarily clear exactly what APRA is going to require. Will we be able to use the different sort of amortised cost or fair value through OCI asset measurement approaches that are in IFRS 9? Currently, they exist in current reporting standards, but we're kind of saying, don't do that, just use the fair value options there. Also tax. Don't know what's going to happen with tax, particularly for, say, YRT, where you might have a big negative liability now. You're not going to have that anymore. I guess my final remark, I'd say, there's still a lot of similarity in how things are going to behave under IFRS Phase 2 compared to MOS. So I guess I have to really tip my hat to the people that developed MOS sort of 20 years ago. It's just taken the IASB 20 years to sort of catch up in their thinking on that. So all right, we'll stop there.
Does anyone have any questions for John?
Will things be more volatile for YRT? Absolutely. Effectively, for YRT, your experience is just going to come through year by year. Your revenue is going to be your premium on that. Under the current measure, if you think that your mortality is going to behave in a different way, you change your assumption, the impact of that gets smoothed out over time. But for YRT, it's going to be a one-year time frame that you're looking over. So you're not, what your view of your future doesn't change anything. In terms of implications for investment management, potentially, yes, there will be impact to the extent, you know, depending on companies' risk appetite and what they're going to focus on. You know, potentially it shouldn't matter. You know, the liabilities themselves aren't changing. You know, I should be investing what's appropriate for those liabilities. That said, you know, if I'm having to present profits to, you know, analysts, you know, and those profits are volatile, you know, then, you know, I may need to, you know, review that asset allocation. Or I've got to, you know, live with it. That said, you know, if I'm thinking about, you know, some of the product lines, they're not going to change hugely. Like if I have an immediate annuity, you know, I've got a relatively fixed liability. And you know, how that will behave shouldn't change too much relative to what we currently have under BOS, for example. If I'm choosing to invest in risky assets, you know, I'd still, and that's not matched on the liability measurement, you know, I will have volatility. It's just a question then of how much companies are prepared to, you know, live with that volatility.
John, which areas of the standard do you think are fairly fixed and which are still sort of up for grabs?
The impression that's coming out, it's all reasonably fixed. You know, as I said, you know, that the basic core measurement model hasn't really changed since it was put down in 2010. You know, how some of the things will work over time have changed. So things like, you know, unlocking the contractual service margin would also get unlocked for changes in the risk adjustment. You know, that wasn't going to happen under the sort of the 2013 proposals. But I think we're at the point where most of those items have been revisited, and the ISP is, you know, currently working on, you know, drafting what's actually going into the standard. You know, some things may get tweaked as we do that, but you know, I wouldn't be expecting fundamental changes from the announced tentative decisions. You know, one of the big changes from 2013 to now. In the 2013, there was a kind of a mirroring approach proposed that would have affected to the participating business, and it was all quite complex, potentially three different measurements applying to one contract, and that's been replaced by the variable fee type approach that we talked about that has, you know, I'd say quite a bit of similarity to what we're currently doing through the VSA.
Firstly, who will be in before you retire? Or more specifically, what do you think the realistic range of actual implementation dates are?
Well, that's a good question. Some people probably thought they would still be here when it was finalised, when it started back in 1997, and a lot of them aren't. Realistically, you know, looking at my bank balance, you know, I'll still be working when it is finalised. I think we can be reasonably certain that, you know, final standard is going to come out relatively soon. Maybe not this year, but, you know, next year. After that, you're looking, you know, maybe a 3 or 4 year time frame before an effective date is mandatory. So I think, yeah, potentially it's a 2020, early 2020 effective date we'll be looking at.
Hi there, I'm off the reserve. I've already asked this question, what's this eventually? Yeah, okay, good answer. I'm going to ask it again. Do you think much impact will be on product development in Australia? Will there be a move towards more level services or guarantee premiums as a result of Scope Phase 2?
I'd probably say no, particularly the latter part. You know, I think companies will probably continue to risk averse and not guarantee premiums. Might there be more of a move to level term? That possibly. Not necessarily, though, driven by IFRS. I think that'll also be driven by things like the life insurance framework and, you know, changes to commission structures. So not necessarily only because of potential implications of IFRS. The other thing to keep in mind, yeah, when we're talking about IFRS, you know, we're not necessarily talking about, you know, a change in the profitability. It's just a change in how the profitability is reported. You know, does it come out in this period or later periods? Yeah. So I don't think it should be a driver of product change, you know, given that. But yeah, I think there are other factors. I think what's going to be important, though, is helping people to understand, particularly things, you know, analysts, investors, you know, what the financials really mean. You know, if I sell that YRT business, it shows a loss. You know, don't worry. You know, I have sold profitable business, and yeah, that will emerge over time. I don't know if that was better than the other response you got.
Given that the standard is still sort of end of 2016, 2017 away, and I know a lot of companies are sort of waiting till that standard comes out before they sort of start doing anything serious, what do you think that companies should start thinking about right now?
Yeah, and you know, I can't sort of blame companies for not, you know, investing lots of money in something that isn't yet finalised. But I don't think they should be ignoring the potential implications, you know, trying to understand, you know, what will it actually mean for their products when it does come in, and thinking about, you know, they're going to, lots of interested parties potentially going to need to be educated about what the changes are, what they mean, what are we going to be needing to tell the story we're going to need to tell to our investors. But they should also, though, be thinking about it from the perspective, even though it's going to come in, you know, it might be 2020, it's going to call largely, or, you know, the primary initial recognition is calling for retrospective application. And so they should be thinking about, you know, are we going to have the information that's going to make it easy for us to do that retrospective application on that? So, given how it is, you know, what investment assumptions would be applying? You know, they're going to be calling for locked-in interest rates. You know, what expenses are we, you know, having, you know, product development or, you know, agent recruitment that aren't going to be deferrable when I have to come back and apply this standard? I think, yeah, the other thing to think about is, yeah, systems development can take a long time. So, yeah, the more you understand it earlier, you know, the better position you're going to be to actually do that implementation, you know, once a final standard is available.
Hi, I'm Alan from Planetal Asset Management. In terms of the implementation, will there be much room for jurisdictional differences? Because there's a lot of accounting rules want to apply, even though it seems like it's an international standard. Inevitably, when different countries apply it, it seems to allow fair room for differences. Is that the case?
In theory, no. In theory, if a country says it's compliant with IFRS, you know, this will be the standard they'll need to be compliant with. That said, you know, companies and countries may and do, and Australia does, you know, direct that certain available approaches, you know, if you have a range of certain available approaches, they might say, you know, use this approach rather than giving companies the flexibility to choose an approach. And I said, yeah, we do currently have that with respect to financial instruments for their asset supporting insurance contract liabilities. You know, we use the fair value measurement option, even though if we were to go to the underlying IFRS, it would say, you know, you have, you know, held to maturity or, you know, amortised cost measurement basis. But, you know, Australia restricts life insurers in particular from applying those to the assets that back the insurance contract liabilities there. Yeah, they may provide additional guidance around, you know, how you set assumptions or, you know, things of that nature, but they should, though, be in a way that's still consistent with you know, what's set out in the IFRS itself. Yeah, would be my expectation. Yeah, so I'd say certainly, but it's going to be a step away from the current situation where, you know, we're basically grandfathered, you know, however many different approaches there are. And yeah, they've, it's got to be an improvement of regional consistency because of that.
So that there were a little bit of wiggle room
in that wording to allow us to do what we really like to do. But it's currently, what was currently proposed, if you check that, absolutely theoretically, really there are problems for a lot of people.
Yeah, no, definitely agree, and that's why we have that locked-in interest rate is one of the real complexities up here.
Could everyone thank John for a very interesting presentation.